Welcome again to another edition of Double Crossed Radio, coming to you live from the Jefferson Republic. And the Jefferson Republic is wherever we are, wherever you are, as long as you're free. And tonight, we have another in-house show, more or less. We're going to have a special guest, Eric Dubin from the News Doctors. But first, I introduce my co-host, Drew Lamb. Drew, welcome.
Hey, Chuck. How's it going?
It's going great. And Eric's going to join us momentarily. I think we're doing the phone thing right now.
Yeah, Eric is on the line.
Okay, Eric, welcome. Okay, great. Okay, before we get into Eric's things, I think we should have a real quick update on Fukushima, because Drew is kind of our guy for Fukushima news, and he posted earlier in the week, or maybe it was the end of last week, over the weekend, sometime recently on Reddit. It was a good story about there's some more Fukushima news about stuff coming across the Pacific in the water. It's now washing up on the shore in Oregon, Washington, California.
Yeah, and this really isn't anything new. I mean, we were seeing radiation in the ocean, you know, years ago, and it was rain out, you know, and so, you know, that was the airborne plume blew over and came down in rain and snow and, you know, of course, ends up in the ocean. So I've talked about this in depth. It was November 2011, I think. I ran into a guy at an In the Fed protest in San Francisco who had been testing kelp in the bay and found that it was radioactive. We were trying to figure out what the source was. Could have been a natural source. Could have been, you know, nuclear waste dumped there. But it was probably rain out. But there's also the ocean-borne plume as well, and this article you're referring to is on Energy News. Actually, this came from the Statesman Journal out of Oregon. What is that? Published in Salem, I believe.
Yes. Actually, he's deceased now, but I had an uncle who was a former editor of that paper.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Huh.
So the headline is Fukushima nuclear waste detected off of U.S. West Coast from California to Canada. There is definitely offshore Fukushima cesium now. Test results will not be revealed to public for several weeks. Here's some excerpts from the Statesman Journal. Fukushima radiation nearing West Coast. Massive amounts of contaminated water were released from Fukushima. Radioactive water has continued to leak and be released from the complex. No state or federal agency is testing Pacific waters for radiation. A sample taken August 2nd, about 750 miles west of Vancouver, BC, tested positive for cesium-137, the Fukushima blueprint, and cesium-137. Further results show offshore Fukushima radiation down the coast into California, including some samples that were closer to shore. The captain of a research vessel offered to collect offshore samples down the entire coast. About 40 offshore test results will be made public next month, said Ken Busler, a chemical oceanographer at Woods Hole at a conference on November 13th. So, yeah, we knew this was going to happen. And there's the massive die-off in the Pacific of all sorts of creatures, primarily starfish. You know, some have speculated that it's due to something else, like the acidification of the ocean. Maybe it is, but I've seen pictures of weird things, you know, seals, sea lions with lesions on their bodies. And I think the most disturbing thing that I saw was a dead conjoined twin gray whale that had washed upon the shore of Mexico. And that's not something that is seen very often. Conjoined twin whales rarely occur. And so this plume will probably continue to get worse over the next 6 years. There's a massive cesium-137 plume. But keep in mind, when the scientists are doing their models for a particular tracer, you know, they're focused on that tracer, but there could be, you know, 2,000 other radioactive contaminants released from Fukushima, you know, and some are pretty bad, you know, like plutonium, strontium-90, you know, the most toxic substances in existence right now in the ocean and blown around in the air. So,
yeah, plutonium is the most deadly element the mankind has ever known. It's just, I mean, it's only like one atom can be deadly.
Well, plutonium bonds with DNA.
Yeah.
And the tragic thing is that if it's blowing around in the wind, I mean, of course, people are ingesting hot particles in their lungs when it's blowing around in the wind. Gunderson was talking about that way back in 2011. He was saying people on average were inhaling 10 hot particles a day, a lot of them up in the Seattle area. But when this material contaminates plants, it causes problems like, they won't produce viable seed. So think about that for a moment. You know, if we have plants, if our plants cannot reproduce, we're either going to starve to death or we're going to have to embrace GMO. You know, so there you have it. Doesn't sound good, and that's what, you know, when we were debating the whole GMO issue a few months ago, I was trying to remind everybody that we might need the GMO if this radioactive contamination continues. It might be the only way to fix the genome of our plants so we could grow crops. So don't turn your back on technology that we might reluctantly need to use.
Okay. Well, I think this is something that all of you guys that are listening to, whether you're listening live tonight or you're on a podcast or if you have YouTube video or someone tells you about it, that they heard it on this podcast, you come in here to listen to check on it, you need to keep an eye on what's going on in Fukushima and all this news, because it's not hitting the mainstream news at all. And it's important to your life and your health and your family's health, children's health, your grandchildren's health. So that's why we bring it up every week. The last 4 weeks, I think we've covered this, three or four weeks. And it's, we're going to, you know, we're back on it because it's important right now, because this this typhoon has really accelerated the movement of these radioactive particles to our part of the world. We've seen counts go up. We've seen it's moved stuff in the ocean faster. We've seen radiation counts going up. It's a problem.
Yes, Geiger counts are, you know, averaging about 40 CPMs. I've been getting spikes up around the 60s. Yesterday was kind of high, was in the 50s quite a bit yesterday.
Yeah, I've noticed every time the wind blows, we get much higher counts.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, we get that wind blowing out of the west, and you could see the Geiger counts increase with the wind gusts sometimes.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we're not going to spend the whole hour talking about that, but we're going to give you guys updates, and we'll probably have another update next week because this is important. But we're going to also, now we're going to bring in our guest, Eric. Who's got a, we're going to start off with a little bit about an amendment that's coming up, or it's been proposed by a candidate for state senator here in Oregon. So those of you who are not in Oregon, if you need to go, use this time for, you should listen to it anyway, because it's important. Okay,
we'll be able to make it a little bit more relevant anyway.
Yeah, this is probably going to be something that you can deal with in your state, or you're going to have to deal with in your state also. So let's talk about the Dodd-Rer Amendment first, and what it means and why it's important.
Well, Dave Dodd-Rer is running for the third Senate district in Oregon, and that's in Jackson County, where we are all located. And what he's proposing to do is to address a problem that is developing out of the Scenic Waterways Program in Oregon that was passed back in 1970. And back in the day when it was passed, it actually was supported by about two-thirds of the Oregon voters. It was an initiative petition that ultimately created the law. It was very popular, but amongst the scope and spirit of the law were the kind of things that you see frequently in even the legislation that created the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States and whatnot. And it's an effort to balance environmental protection with considerations for economic needs and the private property rights of individuals that are impacted by environmental regulation and so forth. And unfortunately, over the decades since it has been passed, there really hasn't been much opportunity for people who are locally impacted by the designation of a river moving into the status of scenic. So what happens is that in Oregon, we have this program, and it's analogous to the national program, actually. There's a Wild and Scenic Rivers Act in the United States. I believe it was passed in 1967, if memory serves. And in Oregon, the analogous program has what amounts to the restrictions of various things that people can do with their lands and the economic activity and so forth surrounding rivers that are declared wild and scenic. And it involves a buffer zone. It's called the riparian buffer zone of a quarter of a mile on each side of the center channel. So, you know, when you deal with any river that gets thrown into this category, it has some pretty significant impacts to the local agricultural producers, the ranchers, and private property owners being able to do what they please with their property and so forth. And the normal process by which these rivers are added to the program involve, at least according to the original statute that created this, lots of opportunity for individuals and locally impacted communities to give some feedback and say whether or not they believe that it's appropriate for any given river to be added. Because, you know, theoretically, people who live in a county or in a community where the river flows knows the most about that particular river and, you know, the economic considerations and what local agricultural conditions are like. And the problem that we've seen reached an apex last year, where Dave Dodd-Rer's competitor, who is the incumbent senator, Senator Alan Bates, in this district, proposed adding 30 rivers to the Wild and Scenic Program, which was, you know, an amazing degree of hubris, I would say, because basically this effort was pushed through Salem, and ultimately was defeated by organizations that bird-dogged the issue and made it a public debate. But prior to efforts like the organization that I run, Citizens for Transparent Government, or the Oregon Farm Bureau, and Oregon's in Action, and some other groups, basically the debate wasn't happening. People were not aware that this large land grab, for lack of a better way of putting it, was going through. And what it amounted to with these 30 rivers was about 14,000 linear miles of waterway. And when you factor in that riparian buffer zone that I was talking about, I mean, it translated into about 4.5 million acres of land. I mean, it's just the scope of this thing was monstrous. And it just goes to represent how the degree to which the bureaucracies in Oregon just, you know, through the process of drifting away from the spirit of the original legislation that created the Scenic Waterways Act, could, you know, take actions like this that are just profoundly sweeping in a gigantic aggrandizement of the bureaucracies that manage the Wild and Scenic or the Scenic Rivers program in Oregon. So when Dave found out about what was going on and the educational efforts the Citizens for Transparent Government was doing, he and I talked a lot about it, and he came up with an idea where it's a pretty straightforward band-aid solution to make sure that the government doesn't go berserk when it comes to trying to placate special interests in the environmental community, and that is to require an additional step for any river to be approved. It would have to meet the voter approval of the county in which the river flows. So the Board of Commissioners would put on the next available ballot, no special election, just no extra cost or anything. It would just be a referendum that would be placed on the ballot that would allow people to either say yes or no to a proposed addition to the program. And that is indeed the Dodderer Amendment. And, some of our opponents would say, oh, you're just trying to be anti-environmental protection and whatnot. And that really isn't what it's all about. It's just about giving locally impacted people the assurance and ability to make sure that what the state government is proposing, in fact, matches the needs and realities on the ground at a county level. So it's very rare for politicians in Oregon these days to go up against the environmental lobby because it's so powerful and it has such huge impacts on our economy here in Oregon. But Dave Dodderer is doing it, and I think that people should check out what the Dodderer Amendment is about. And we don't want me to talk a lot about it here, but since this is a local show with a lot of people that do listen in the Oregon community, it's relevant. So I'd suggest people go to Google and enter Dodderer Amendment, and it'll come up right there. You'll see an interview that I did with Dave, as well as Dennis Linthicum, the county commissioner in Klamath County, that's been on this show a couple of times. So,
yeah, he's actually, Dennis is, I think he's going to be on our show next week again.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, yeah, it is an election season, and Oregonians will find this interesting. And it is relevant as well, too, when it comes to just
this. Yeah, this is, as we started to say, this is something that's really is relevant to everybody else in the United States. Back in the Clinton administration, I'm that old that I was an old man during the Clinton administration. they passed a this wasn't really an amendment to the Constitution. It was a Congress passed a law. It's called the Navigable Waters Act, I believe it was what it was called, or something to that effect.
Yep.
And it basically gave the federal government authority over any water that could be navigated on by a boat, which could have commerce on it. They're using the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. And then they broadened that a little bit to include all the waters that flowed into waters that could be navigated by a boat, which in just about every river in the United States. And this is all in the name of trying to conserve environment. And they use some really good examples of rivers that have been just turned into toilets. But out here in our part of the woods, there really our waterways are relatively clean compared to the examples that they were using. Now, I'm not going to say that our own local Bear Creek is a source of good, clean drinking water or anything by any means, because it's got a lot of irrigation runoff. And when it rains like it has the last couple days, it washes a lot of fecal material from the fields and stuff into drainage ditches, which find their way into Bear Creek. So it's probably full of crap right now, literally. And so there are times when it's not really a valid waterway, but that kind of washed through by just kind of goes over rocks, and it kind of oxygenates itself, and the bacteria take care of that stuff, and it kind of is like a sewage treatment plant for a couple of weeks, maybe, or a week or so, and then it's cleaned up again. We understand we have a problem there, but it's something that everybody lives here and knows about. It isn't really a big problem. Yet they could come in and put all sorts of restrictions on farmers, people who are grazing cattle, people who are raising horses. There's a couple people I know here that raise quarter horses, and they make a lot of money doing that. It's a big industry for people to raise quarter horses in the United States, and that's one of the things that people around here do. It's a good climate for it. They raise healthy horses here. But if suddenly someone comes along and says, "Hey, you got to contain all this stuff. You got to pick it up after. You got to pick up after your horses because this is getting into the water." And this Navigable Rivers Act, whatever, we can come in here and we can close you down. Well, they really shouldn't have authority over local interests in this manner, where they have to prove that this is really becoming a problem. And it's really, I tell you, there's the irrigation runoff from the agricultural fields is a problem. But, man, what if someone wanted to go to organic farming and then they were being closed down because there's fecal material in the water, and they think it's coming from this organic because it's using cow manure as fertilizer. Well, cow manure as fertilizer probably produces a lot healthier produce for people to eat than the chemical crap they spray on it, which really kills the soil. So anyway, what we're saying is that if a local area wanted to say, "Hey, we can live with this. We know we shouldn't drink this water. We should have to treat it first before we can drink it. Let it run. By the time it gets to the Rogue River, it's clean." Yes, it is.
And to focus on, you know, what it relates to on a bigger picture for everyone that's not just in Oregon, local communities and, in fact, even the state-level environmental protection agencies have a better understanding of what goes on within each individual state. And the spirit of the Environmental Protection Agency when it was created, the arguments that were put forward by lawmakers in Congress justifying the establishment of the agency was actually focused on creating something that would help pool the resources and focus of the environmental protection community, but centrally within it, leverage each individual state's ability to regulate their own environment. And that, just like the Scenic Waterways Act, has been kind of going through this kind of transformation as the pull and tug of political jockeying from interest groups and whatnot, combined with just the nature of bureaucracies to grow and replicate themselves in terms of their power and so forth. Nowadays, the EPA, as you're talking about, is talking about regulating all bodies of water that migrate into a stream. So even a puddle, conceivably, can, in fact, come under regulation, justifying the regulation of land. So
yeah, it could be a storm drain.
And the revelations about the EPA map-making that they've done in this last year and the scope at which they're basically wringing their hands and drooling over the level of control that the agency will have would, have people back in the Nixon era when the EPA was created just kind of shaking their heads because it's grown into this very hyper-aggressive regulatory body. And all this stuff is worthy for a whole show all by itself because it is kind of complex and whatnot. But
I think it all boils down to what this amendment is about, is we want to kind of have more control over our own lives and not cede that liberty and that freedom to bodies that are increasingly, further and further distances away from us.
Yeah. So anyway, people, go to Google, type in Dotterer Amendment, and
you may end up having something similar to this trying to shove down your throat in your state. You may want to understand this or even copy this so you're armed and ready if it ever should happen. But I think it's time we kind of turn to our main topic for tonight, and that's the
wild and woolly financial world, eh?
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on, and if you just listen to CNBC and maybe the Fox Financial Channel, whatever, you'd think that we're in a recovery and that we're having the stock market's never been better. We recently hit an all time high, and then we've had a kind of a big drop off from that all time high. So let's start with first the stock market. It's not that healthy these days.
No, I mean, we have a lot of impacts that we can see in our financial markets that are basically benefiting from all of the liquidity that's generated by the central banks around the world. I mean, Japan and the UK and our Fed have basically been in an orgy of monetary creation, of fiat expansion of the monetary system. There was an article a couple months back, I don't remember the exact date, but the Financial Times did a really great expose about how they discovered that upwards of $29 trillion of funds have been circulating in financial markets at the creation, or because of the creation that the Federal Reserve and their compatriots at other central banks have been floating. And, I mean, when you think about that in terms of numbers, there's so many zeros behind it, it's kind of hard to wrap your brain around, but that basically is roughly the equivalent of two times what the gross domestic product of the United States puts out every year. So to say that that's a massive amount of liquidity generation is an understatement galore, and it has everything to do with why our stock market is as high as it is. You know, companies across America have, you know, the Fortune 500 universe, et cetera, have been able to take out loans at very low, artificially suppressed interest rates that are directly the result of the manipulation that the Federal Reserve is doing. And in turn, they bought about $1 trillion worth of stock in the last couple of years. And that's been one of the major pillars that are, in fact, been keeping the stock market elevated. And speculation also becomes far easier to do when you're able to borrow and lever up as a hedge fund, or, you know, a Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan or what have you, internal trading desks. You know, they're able to go into the Fed and get almost 0% financing for their stock books. And they go out and they buy assets left and right. And then on top of that, you have this whole kind of fake economic recovery that has been going on since our crash in 2009, where it's been pretty bad in the United States, but if you go over into Europe, it's just horrendous. So the economic downturn that is happening in Europe, combined with all the geopolitical machinations of threats of war and actual wars and so forth, are making so much instability around the world that people are taking assets out of worldwide financial markets and dumping them into the United States. And for the first, you know, three quarters of this year, we've seen quite a bit of that flow buttressing the market and pushing it higher. So, you know, you normally you'd think, oh, corporate profits and interest rates combined to be the two fundamental reasons why stock markets either go higher or lower, depending on if you're making more money with corporations and the economy and healthy interest rates being such that it creates, you know, economic activity and higher rates of, you know, velocity of money and so forth going around in our economy. But in reality, when you look at what's going on in the United States and abroad, the engine of economic growth is kind of broken. And what we have is further financialization that's creating these profits, where, you know, the corporations are able to reduce the number of shares that they have outstanding with their buybacks, such that anytime they report their earnings, it's divided by a lower number of shares, and thus the earnings per share is larger. And that is something that in conventional Wall Street circles, investors and so forth look at and say, oh, you know, okay, stock is worth more because it's generating a larger amount of income as a share. And that's what happens when you have $1 trillion worth of buybacks distorting the level of the valuation of the marketplace. I mean, it adds, you know, just kind of back of the napkin numbers. I mean, I'd have to do some serious calculations to give you an exact number. So that qualifier said, you're still probably talking about, you know, 15% or so of the appreciation that we've seen in the stock market in the last year being strictly just the impact of these buybacks.
Wow. I'm going to throw in a couple of random thoughts here that I'm getting from Michael Snyder's piece that he wrote a while back. I think it was on the 20th, it's called 19 Very Surprising Facts About the Messed Up State of the U.S. Economy. And he started out, he makes a statement, this is before he gets to his 19 facts. He says that the percentage of Americans that are employed has barely budged since the depths, that means the bottom of the last recession. Labor force participation rate is at a 36-year low. And yet they're saying we're recovering. We're recovering. This is not much of a recovery, is it?
No.
There really isn't any job creation. The jobs that are being created are the people are being fired from full-time jobs because they can't afford to pay for Obamacare, so they're getting two part-time jobs. And so that every full-time job is, or a lot of full-time jobs are being broken in two to have, instead of earning 40 hours a week, you have two 20-hour-a-week jobs, and they're calling that job creation.
Yeah, and 3 weeks back, I believe, or 2 weeks back, the most recent monthly report for the unemployment report was released, and we have fallen back down to 5.9% unemployment rate. And the main reason why the number was as low as it was is precisely because people are just dropping out of the labor force. We have the lowest level of labor force participation since the early 1970s. I think it's 1973 that we're on par with. And a lot of people say, well, that's just the result of the baby boomers retiring and all that other nonsense. But in reality, if you look at the big picture, we point in time and forward, quite a few people were coming into the force as women began to work more frequently. You know, as households, women started moving into the workforce in earnest in the 1970s. So the reality is that we have the lowest level as a percentage of our population of people working in the United States, and the jobs that they're doing are of lower quality and lower income, and they're taking on a lot more part-time positions, as you noted. The labor report that came out a couple weeks back had the only segments of the population getting gains in employment were 55 and older, as well as the 16 through 19 segment. So you're basically getting Walmart greeters and lots of other part-time stuff that people who are well past the key level of earnings in terms of their growth for the economy, you know, just the 30, 40-year-olds or so is like the core of an economic engine in any given country, and those are the people that are hurting the absolute most by losing the higher-paying jobs.
Yeah, Michael Snyder also makes a point in his saying that the jobs gained during the recovery period, we've had some recovery, they pay an average of 23% less than the jobs that were lost during the recession. So.
Yeah.
Even if they were full-time jobs, it's like having 25% of them not being there because they're low-quality jobs.
Yeah.
They're not producing much wealth.
And the average American's standard of living has declined 38% since 2003. It's just astounding what is happening with the hollowing out of the American economy.
Yeah, they say that a typical American household is now worth 36% less than it was a decade ago. So in 10 years, we've lost 36% of our net worth. That's just horrible.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this is kind of a byproduct of this financialization process where, you know, back in the 1950s, the United States had pretty decent in the manufacturing economy. We're just after the World War, and the United States was the leading economy in the world. I mean, at one point we had about half of the product that was produced in the world at the turn of that war. And now that manufacturing base has shrunk down to about 9, 10, 12% of the economy. It kind of depends on what you count as manufacturing. I remember like about a decade ago, as the powers that be manipulate and want to, massage statistics and whatnot, they were actually counting the service industries, McDonald's, burger flippers as manufacturing. I mean, these kind of nonsense games happen all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, now we have the financial sector talking, say, 35% of profits in the country, and the vast majority of that is non-productive activity that has absolutely nothing to do with the real economy. It's just financialization, paper pushing, and it's incredibly unhealthy. And then when you layer on top of that this insane financial liquidity cycle where, you know, every time we get a big old bubble, the Federal Reserve and other central banks freak out. They come in with so-called remedies to rescue the financial system because the financial system is now so important. They have basically no great choice, sort of a Faustian bargain. They have to come in and do something on a short-term basis to fix the problem, and then they end up sowing the seeds of the next bubble. And we've gone through the cycle over and over and over again, and each time the bubble gets bigger and bigger, and that's essentially what people are worried about now, because we have what amounts to the biggest bubble in world history in our credit markets. The malinvestments and insolvency that the banks held largely in the private sector that created the crash of 2008, 2009, have now been transferred to the balance sheets of the central banks around the world, and the people in these countries are ultimately the backstop of that that huge amount of debt. We're on the hook for it, the taxpayers now. So, and the problems haven't been fixed. Now we have sovereign debt that is so high that countries are at risk of finding their financial sovereignty at risk of just falling apart.
Yeah, I think that we owe a debt. If you count all of our future liabilities, we owe a debt that the world couldn't repay, let alone our nation.
Yeah, I mean, the computation of our debt on an annual basis is completely skewed by being able to keep things off financial balance sheets. You know, that we don't count all of the expenses of war, and on and on and on. And so, you know, Barack Obama's administration is making a big deal about having reduced the debt into about $500 billion or so range this year. But in reality, if you were to use generally agreed upon standards of accounting, the actual debt this year would be well north of $2 trillion. And when you look at the bigger picture, in terms of the net present value of all of our long-term obligations from our entitlement programs and whatnot, people like Lawrence Cockbrook-Roth over in Boston University has estimated that the number is well north of $200 trillion. So, and again, the United States' economy runs at about $16 trillion per year or so in terms of what it generates. So, these levels of debt are impossible to pay off, and at some point there's going to be some kind of a reconciling comeuppance of the financial markets pushing back. And the strategy that the powers that be are employing now is what they call financial repression. And the term comes from the 1950s, where there was a long period of time where the powers that be tried to basically grow out of the debt burden that was created by the World War II. And unfortunately, the level of debt that we have now basically makes that not a viable strategy, but that's basically what the Ben Bernankes and Janet Yellens of the world are still continuing to follow. And it's not going to look pretty, because other countries around the world are looking with a jaundiced eye at the dollar standard, and they're moving their trade away from the dollar to protect themselves, wisely so, because it's in their economic interests. And those dynamics are going to kind of put a halt to this whole charade at some point. I think that within the next 3 years, we're looking at the end game window. It's going to be an evolutionary process with bursts of deflationary crashes here and there when it comes to financial markets and so forth. It's going to be a really, really rocky ride. I mean, in the short term, we've already gone through this period where we've had a modest correction in the stock market, and now we're gearing up towards the election. We've had a really big pullback in the price of oil worldwide, which acts as a very big stimulus to economic activity and whatnot. So, I mean, even though if you just turn back the clock to last week, and people were kind of freaking out, midweek last week, stock market was still going through its process of moving down, and the 10-year yield for the U.S. bonds were crashing because so many people were leaving the stock market and putting money into bonds that the yield went down to 2.15%, which is just astounding. I mean, the normal average rate is like 6% or so over the last 100 years for the United States. So when the cost of money has been as low as it is now, for people to create more debt obligations and whatnot as they push around the financial instruments, you get a lot of excessive speculation, malinvestment and whatnot, and that links up with the fact that the economy isn't as strong as people believe, but the perception is that it's doing fine because the stock market is being supported by all this easy credit.
I want to get back to this in just a second, so hold that thought for a second. I have to. It occurred to me that our previous topic, the Dodd Amendment, is very relevant here, because a lot of the things that are happening here, they kind of are stemming from we're losing production jobs. We're losing production jobs because of regulation and bureaucratic oversight is making the expense of being a productive type of enterprise in this country very expensive. In fact, Just reading here in Michael Snyder's thing, he said that the rate of small business ownership is plunged to an all-time low. There's a reason for that. It is impossibly expensive. Drew can talk to this about how he's regulated in the little enterprise that he's doing there. It's incredibly burdensome, and we're driving all these jobs overseas. We're driving them out of country. We're just ending some of them because they're just not worth doing anymore. And small business, which used to be the generated most of the new jobs in this country, is disappearing. And so this Dodd Amendment that we started off, I didn't know it was going to be this relevant. It's extremely relevant. This is one of the things that we need to do in order to bring jobs back to areas that are economically depressed, like Jackson County.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't want to overstate the magnitude of what the Dodd Amendment and the relevance.
Well, it's one thing, but it's the type of thing we need to do.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it points to the just over level of regulation in the economy overall. And I've read estimates that put, say, 14 or so percent of our entire economic output as merely complying with regulations. I mean, the level of regulations in the U.S. economy are such that it's now no longer just about trying to theoretically do something good by protecting the environment or making sure that workers are safe because of OSHA regulations or on and on. You can pick your example. The problem is that the level of bureaucratic morass with the level of regulatory bureaucracies that have grown up are such that these bureaucracies are kind of self-replicating. They have a social interest. I mean, anyone who's studied social theory understands that organizations protect their own interest and grow. They're like organisms. And it's no surprise to see that at the advanced stage of decay in our economy in the United States that these, you know, the regulatory burdens are just going out of control. And that EPA example about regulating every single drop of water over the entire United States is a perfect example. So, you know, it's really difficult to see how we're going to get through these problems without some kind of a shock to make people stop, take stock of what's going on, and try to look at things from a different perspective, because there's so much that's on autopilot with so many individual sections of the economy and individual actors basically just pursuing their own interest within bureaucracies and government. Yeah, and
this is something that we've talked about on the show a couple times in the past 4 or 5 months, but one of the basic tenets, this is maybe oversimplifying things a little bit, but sometimes I think that's a healthy thing. So look at it from a simple as possible point of view, is that in order to generate wealth, you have to produce something. And we're putting so much, so many constraints on the people that actually produce wealth. I mean, producing wealth is you're harvesting a natural resources like timber or maybe mining or growing food or you know, livestock. Those are productions. You're producing some wealth.
Even real economic activity related to expanding anything with respect to productivity, so technology industries.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, I mean, it's not just the natural resource base, it's also what layers on top of the ground building blocks of the economy, which are natural resources.
Here in Jackson County, we rely a lot on those natural resource types of economies, and they've been shutting them down one by one, and there's virtually none of that here anymore, especially in the logging industry. There's a little tiny bit going on in some of the privately held forests, and that's about it. Most of the economy we get here is money that we get from the rest of you taxpayers in the United States funding the fire suppression, the futile fire suppression efforts of the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management. But it's just, that is a destruction of wealth, that we're just trying to manage the destruction of wealth and burning down the forests. There's nobody's winning in that battle at all, and so it's this bureaucratic morass that you describe. It really is a hideous way of destroying an economy. Bastiat once noted that a tariff is the same as a negative railroad. It does the opposite of what a railroad does. It slows the exchange of goods from one place to another. I would have to say these regulations are much the same kind of animal.
Well, they're definitely out of control, and the level of regulation in the United States needs to be addressed at some point, and unfortunately probably will not be addressed in large measure until we actually have some kind of a social disruption that's most likely going to come from our financial markets.
Yeah, well, back to the rant we were on before I interrupted you. Sorry about that. I just felt like I had to say it before I forgot about it. Right now, we have an all-time high in the number of people in this country that are dependent on the government to eat. There are close to 50 million people, maybe more than that, that are they get food stamps, and that's the only way that they survive from day to day is with food stamps. That's about 14% of our population, approximately. To me, that seems like that's way too high.
Well, it gets back to what we were talking about, the decline in the standard of living and poor jobs and so forth. I mean, you know, 1 in 6 people in the country are on food stamps, and then when you lay on top of that all the other various programs that help people make a living, you're talking about maybe 1 in 2 people who, excuse me, and 1 in 6. 2 in 6 instead of just the 1 in 6 that are on food stamps alone. So, and that ends up creating a social class that ends up seeking to support politics and politicians that perpetuate that economic model, and you end up getting more distortions in the economy. So, I mean, it's what's going on now is kind of like the devolution of a large empire along the lines of what we saw in history with the British Empire and the Roman Empire. I mean, there are so many allegories to the past, and unfortunately, as it has been said many a time, those who do not learn from history will be doomed to repeat it, and that's exactly what's happening now.
Yeah, I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to look at what's happening, look at the proposed measures to quote-unquote fix things, to realize that nothing that's been proposed is sustainable, and it can't possibly fix what's going on, because you can't, and the cost of the fix is more than just letting things fall apart in the long run. And it's, you can't just keep inflating a balloon that has a huge hole in it. You're spending all your time and energy trying to keep something afloat when the air is going out almost as fast as you can put it in, if not faster. Yeah. And it's time to pick a different strategy and kind of relook at the problem, I think. I'm hoping that if you're listening to this and you understand what we're talking about and you kind of see the grim reality that these statistics show, and they really are not nothing to smile about. Any of this is kind of scary, actually. That you, when you talk to somebody about it, you'd bring this up. You'd bring up the fact that 7 million Americans are working in part-time jobs when they'd rather be working in a full-time job. Just think how it's not that they only want to work 20 hours a week or 25. That isn't what it is. Those full-time jobs aren't there. Why aren't they there? It's because no one can afford to pay health care for a full-time worker, or there's very few people. There's at least 7 aren't worth minimum wage, full-time job, and health care at the same time. They just aren't worth that much money. They can't produce enough wealth to pay for all those things for the employer. So he can't afford to have them, so he has to have 2 part-time guys instead. And so what would be a solution to that? Well, they think, well, what we need is more QE. Well, one solution maybe to make the Obamacare, maybe make that voluntary. Now, I know there wouldn't be a lot of people signing up for it, but maybe they should take some insight from that. That if a lot of people aren't signing up for it, maybe it's not such a great program. Maybe it's a kind of a waste of money. Maybe it's a bad thing. You know, it's
I mean, just at basic logic, people can understand Obamacare from the perspective that if you're going to try to reduce costs by adding a government bureaucratic layer on top of an industry, name me one example in history of the United States where that's actually reduced the costs of an industry. I mean, there are so many proposals and ideas that could actually reduce the cost of medicine and the provision of care to more people. And it's all, more along the lines of free market solutions and just things that we just don't do in this country, unfortunately.
We haven't done for a long time. So there's more to it. There's a we have to relax all kinds of regulations. Now some regulations I think maybe you should wait until the very end to see if you really want to get rid of it or not. But I want to propose to everybody out there that there probably isn't a regulation that exists that couldn't be just taken away. And you say, well, who's gonna keep people from employing children to work in industries? And said, well, you know, if a kid really is not learning anything in school, like did they learn anything in school these days, why shouldn't he be out learning how to work? I don't think people want to see kids hurt or injured or put in dangerous situations. I don't think they would necessarily do that. I mean, I don't know anybody that would employ a kid to work on a dangerous piece of machinery that he was didn't have the experience, wasn't able to work on it. We're talking about thinking he might potentially have a life-ending injury or something, or a life-altering injury. I don't think there are people out there that rise to that level of being an employer that would stick somebody who is not capable into that kind of a position. But yet there are a lot of things that kids could do that would teach them a lot of things about work ethic and teach them the value. Maybe I do want to go and learn some more stuff in school and not just goof off in class because I don't want to be doing this the rest of my life. You know, they could learn those kinds of lessons too.
Yeah,
that's one of the things that happened to me when I was growing up. I was out working in the orchards here in Jackson County, and that's hard work. And I said, man, I don't want to have to do this for the rest of my life to make a living. I want to be doing something a little more productive, a little bit that's worth a little bit more. And so there's a lot of good benefits that can come from repealing some of these regulations that maybe don't have too much to do with. They aren't being as effective as you think they are. If we'd repealed some of these regulations, people would be working more productive jobs, and they wouldn't have to work 40 hours to make a living. Really, with the age of computers and all the automation that we have, we should be living like kings.
Yeah, not that I want to date you or whatnot, but, you know, back in the 1960s and earlier, which you don't all go back that far, but it was just kind of common.
I do.
People would, you know, employ their 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old in the various trades that are common for whatever the family was involved with. It was just normal. I mean, I was 6 years old when I first got my job of licking stamps for my grandfather and his company. Yeah, I had that really early teaching when it comes to the work ethic. But, you know, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, child labor laws, even OSHA and all these other things are actually the very small component of that, the overhang of regulation that we were talking about before, representing 14-some-odd% of the economy. The really big guns are all of the environmental restrictions and whatnot. I mean, Obama personally has
Americans with Disabilities Act
output by like 30% just in the time he's been in office. You know, that is a gigantic punch in the nose to the U.S. economy because it raises the cost of absolutely everything, because electricity is, you know, a fundamental building block to economic activity. Those are the kind of big picture economic regulation issues that the American people need to have a grown-up discussion about, because all of the stuff that's going on with respect to the coal industry example I just gave, you know, links up directly to paranoia about man-made climate change / global warming, which is well detached from the actual science, even though the powers that be like to tell us that 97% of the scientists around the world agree that climate change is directly related to man-made activity. Carbon taxes are coming in 2016. In Oregon, they're talking about raising the gas tax for another buck. These are levels of economic restrictions that ultimately are tied to the goal of reducing the perceived carbon footprint of the output of economic activity to 1990 levels of carbon emissions. And when you burn fossil fuels, you create carbon emissions. So, you know, they're basically talking about by 2020 and by 2050, depending on where you are, depending on what county you've got and what kind of government you got in your county and all the economic activities and whatnot, we're shooting for a goal of having, by 2050 at the latest, economic activity and an associated carbon output footprint of 1990 levels. When you consider the impact to the economic activity that would have, it's just monumental.
I think at that point,
renewable energy sources can't fix that gap.
I agree, and I think at that point, America becomes a third world nation.
It's happening.
Yeah, we're on that slide right now. It's just going to get steeper and more rapid as you get closer to that point. But this is another great reason why we need a Jefferson Republic. We need to have something that kind of withdraws from the United States. We still have an association and bonds and ties to the United States, but we want to be our own sovereign place, and we don't want to go by your laws anymore because they're screwing us out of our future. Kind of one of the points why we started this program a couple of years ago is that we really did. It wasn't just a romantic notion having Jefferson Republic. We really think that the people who live in this region. We have the ability to govern ourselves and to protect our own environment and to do things in a sensible and reasonable, logical manner. And we don't need someone 3,000 miles away telling us how to live our lives. We certainly don't think it's right for the rest of the country to take away our livelihood through the regulations they have on logging and the mining restrictions and the grazing restrictions and the restrictions on how you grow your crops and carbon emissions and everything else.
Yeah.
They don't have to pay any economic price. We pay it all.
And one of the themes that your show has championed all along is this kind of race between the forces of centralization and the powers that be trying to keep everything tied together, which involves repression on the political front and economic degradation because of the policies that they do with the QE, et cetera, that we talked about earlier, basically keeping everything together by flooding the system with credit and whatnot, also contributes to ever-increasing concentration of economic power in our society versus the forces of decentralization, the idea that, regions are being politically motivated to create some republic secession or, the secession movement and Colorado or Texas is even talked about going alone. I mean, these kind of things are a natural outcropping, a byproduct of a system in distress. It's not happening by accident. People are looking around going, hey, wait a minute. This process of being involved with a greater economic and political unit of the United States has its problems. And people look around saying, maybe we need to rethink how we're relating to the federal government.
Yeah. Well, this has been an awesome discussion, Eric. Thank you again for coming on the show tonight. We're going to have the background music coming on or the bumper music coming on pretty quick, so I wanted to thank you before that happened, and thank everybody for listening. And, Eric, make sure you come back on the show again soon. A lot of great information to share with everybody. I hope that if you missed some of the points here that you can catch the replay. It's posted on the UCY's page right after our show is over. It goes up almost immediately, and then in a couple hours after that it'll be appeared on the YouTube. If you want to be able to skip forward to certain parts of the show, it's a little easier to do it on that. You can also download the app and listen to it on your phone or your other smart device like an iPad, and just share it with your friends. Keep the show growing. We're not doing this to make money. We're doing this to spread information and to try and combat the lack of information that comes out of the mainstream media. So thanks again, Eric.
Well, thank you. And if anybody wants to check out the stuff, thenewsdoctors.com.
The News Doctors is a great news source. We post a lot of things from them on our Facebook page.
And I do the Silver Doctors weekly radio
wrap. Including some things from a guy named Chuck Horton. Yeah.
Yeah, that guy. He's got his own button over on thenewsdoctors.com.
Yeah. Okay, we'll see you all next week. Thanks all for listening.
Thank you.
You're bound to break one more time.